I next met with Dr. Corey Langer and asked him to present a few cases that made important teaching points about new directions in management of small cell lung cancer, and he began by presenting a 76-year-old man.
So this is a lovely gentleman who presented over 2.5 years ago now with multifocal squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. He was treated originally with carbo and gemcitabine, had a very good response, and we opted to give radiation to the bulk tumor site. He had had multifocal disease. Most of the smaller lesions had either disappeared or they looked like scar. We gave concurrent chemo, pac carbo with radiation, standard dose, 60 gray, about 2.5 years ago, February 2012 through March 2012. And he did fine for a while. And then about 6 months later, he had regrowth of the right upper lobe, right lower lobe, and right hilar lesions that were treated with stereotactic radiation. And then he had resumption of pac carbo through September and then progressed at that point. After improving for a bit, he progressed again in March of 2013, got monthly carbo with weekly nab-paclitaxel, again based on the recent data from the Szczesny paper suggesting that nab-pac might have preferential activity in squamous cell, and stabilized in the right lower lobe with marked decrease in the other lesions. So it looked like we were doing well again. But by July of 2013, finally had further progression. So he had had this sort of seesaw of responses and progression on fairly standard squamous cell therapy.
Before you get to the exciting part of the case, any comments on nab-paclitaxel, which you used in this case?
I generally dose nab-pac weekly, so you avoid the typical neuropathy you'd see with standard solvent-based paclitaxel when it's dosed every 3 weeks. As opposed to an uninterrupted schedule, I will use what I call the QA regimen, which is 3 weeks in a row and then a week off. So typically 80 to 100 milligrams per meter squared weekly, 3 weeks in a row every 4 weeks, and carbo dosed at an AUC of 5 or 6 every 4 weeks. And I find that an extraordinarily well-tolerated regimen. Many of these folks do get some neuropathy, but it's generally quite mild, and it usually reverses a bit faster and a bit more profoundly than you typically see with standard solvent-based paclitaxel. So at least in squamous cell patients, and particularly in patients over the age of 70, I have been using this agent more and more.
Why in older patients?
So there was a subset analysis of the Szczesny trial, the phase 3 trial that compared weekly nab-pac to conventional paclitaxel given every 3 weeks with the fixed dose of carbo. And roughly 15 or 16% of the enrollees were over 70, about 150 patients overall. And granted, this was a post hoc analysis, but at least in the nab-pac arm, the median survival was over 19 months compared to about 10.3, 10.4 months in the control arm. Now, granted, it could have been serendipity, or perhaps it's just the schedule of the taxane, but nevertheless, those data have certainly been compelling for me. And I've been using that regimen increasingly over the past 1.5 to 2 years in individuals 70 years of age or older.
So one other question about this man. Globally, how did you view him? I mean, he's 76 years old. Was he in generally good condition? Was he having any symptomatology from the tumor itself? How were you approaching him?
Well, in July of 2013, he actually wasn't terribly symptomatic. He has some underlying emphysema, so he has some dyspnea on exertion, but still quite functional. He had only just retired maybe 6 months earlier, definitely enjoying life. By the end of the summer, though, the right lower lobe mass, which was relatively small at the beginning of 2013, had enlarged to about 9 by 10 centimeters. It was quite enormous. He had developed a right supraclavicular node. And at that point, I really felt as if we were certainly out of standard therapeutic options. He had already progressed on taxanes. I suppose I could have reintroduced gemcitabine. I was a bit fearful because he's received a lot of radiation, and those sorts of patients who have been heavily radiated in the past, you often see a recall phenomenon. I did not want to contend with that, particularly in an older individual who already has baseline breathing trouble. And as most of the listeners are aware, we've seen a tsunami of immunotherapy trials now, particularly focusing on PD-1 and PD-L1 in thoracic malignancy. And at our own institution, we had the phase 1 Merck trial open. Fortuitously, he had developed a right supraclavicular node. These trials generally mandate a biopsy proximal to the time of starting therapy. So that was a relatively accessible site to go after. We biopsied it. We confirmed a recurrent squamous cell. Unfortunately, his tumor was PD-L1 negative, and just at the time we biopsied him, that cohort had closed. So I was very disappointed. I thought I'd have no opportunity to put him on that trial. And within a week later, apparently there was an opening on the trial. I suppose some patient who was supposed to be in the PD-L1 negative cohort didn't get on for various reasons. So we were able literally to snag the last slot on that trial. He was quite happy to be enrolled. I told him the alternatives really were more systemic chemo or broad-based phase ones that weren't specific for a particular diagnosis. And really within 2 months, whatever shortness of breath or cough he had completely dissipated. The mass shrank by about 30-40%. The right supraclavicular node, at least on CAT scan, shrank from 21 millimeters to 14 millimeters. It was no longer palpable, whereas before it had been palpable. And each time I've seen him since, he comes in at 2-week intervals for treatment. He gets scans at 2-month intervals. He shows further diminution in his right lower lobe mass. The right supraclav node at this point is undetectable. He has had virtually no toxicity. We think of these new agents as causing quite a bit in the way of autoimmune toxicity or fatigue. And that's certainly true of the CTLA-4 inhibitors, in particular ipilimumab. But the PD-1 and PD-L1 monoclonals, I believe, are quite a bit safer. They certainly have their own toxicity, and some patients will have major toxicity. But I've now had experience with the Merck compound, at least a dozen or more patients, and for the most part, there's been very little in the way of side effects. Each scan, intriguingly, shows some further decrease, not quite so profoundly as we've seen with the original interval from October till December 2013, but I saw him back just last week, so that was his August follow-up, and there was another 2 to 3 millimeter diminution in the right lower lobe mass, which now measures maybe 38 by 48 millimeters. And again, no other sites have cropped up. His previously irradiated sites, you sort of see the usual time-related fibrosis that sets in post-radiation. I've certainly not seen any exacerbation. There's been no evidence of pulmonary toxicity or radiation recall, which would be a major concern with some of our conventional cytotoxics. And he's a lucky guy. PD-L1 negative tumors aren't supposed to respond all that well to these new class of compounds, although if you look at the literature as presented at meetings, every single one of these agents has been used in PD-L1 negative, and there's always some small subset that does in fact have a response. So I think at best, PD-L1 staining is a very imperfect marker. We need something better. We perhaps need to combine that with other immunomarkers, and I don't think we really know what that is as yet. Many of the studies call for a year of treatment and then observation. We're on the cusp of having to deal with that issue. Come October, if the study mandates his going off or at least being observed at that point, given the total lack of side effects, I will probably petition the phase 1 group to see if we can't keep going. If not, we'll observe him closely and see if we can't resume treatment should he progress. But I think he sort of illustrates what we're seeing. Maybe 1 in 6, 1 in 7 advanced non-small cell patients, extremely heavily pretreated patients, seem to be deriving amazing benefit from this class of compounds.
Although I guess, I mean, the level of his response is good. I mean, it certainly didn't go away, but it seems like maybe what's been more impressive is the duration.
Which is something we're seeing more and more. And generally, those who do respond often have quite durable responses. And at least based on the original data that Julie Bramer and others have shown, the responses often will continue without maintenance treatment, basically on observation after a year. So that sort of flies in the face of our typical approach with maintenance therapy. I'll be extraordinarily gratified if we can get another year or two out of this, but if you look at some of the data in melanoma, some of these patients are doing incredibly well, 4 years, 5 years in some cases. So I hesitate to use the cure word, but there's something peculiar and incredibly gratifying going on with this new class of compounds. The problem is it's still a minority, a relatively small minority of patients who will ultimately benefit. And as I mentioned, PD-L1 is an imperfect marker. We need to do better. But certainly if you're going to introduce these agents earlier in the disease course, either first line or second line, then I think it's quite reasonable to use the PD-L1 marker as a discriminant for enrollment. Several companies are actually looking at this class of agents up front in treatment-naive individuals. BMS, for instance, is comparing nivolumab to standard platinum-based combinations in a PD-L1 positive treatment-naive advanced non-small cell. 2 years ago, when that concept was first floated, I was incredibly skeptical, and I thought that was playing with fire. We have standard frontline treatment. Why not wait till second or third or fourth line? But at least anecdotally, in small series, and we're talking very small series, 15 patients, 20 patients, response rates are respectable, and some of them are quite durable. So it's not unreasonable, certainly in a motivated patient. And then there are combinations. Nirisvi and others have looked at nivolumab with standard chemotherapy. These are very early phase 1 trials. Toxicity doesn't seem to be exacerbated, but I'm not terribly impressed by any obvious improvement in response rates compared to standard chemo. So I know many of my colleagues feel very strongly that these drugs will be particularly effective if they're given in combination with our standard therapies. I'm a bit dubious. I need to see more data, particularly randomized phase 2 data. And of course, there's a tremendous interest in combining it with other immunotherapy agents, and that's already being done in melanoma. So CTLA-4 inhibitors with PD-1 inhibitors, that's just starting in lung cancer. And again, that initiates or can cause a level of toxicity that may be a bit more than these advanced non-small cell patients can handle. Remember, these patients are generally older with more comorbidities compared to the standard melanoma patient. So I worry about those combos. CTLA-4, though, is being looked at. There is a huge randomized phase 3 trial comparing chemo alone to PAC-carbo combined with ipilimumab on a sort of delayed basis, basically grafting the ipilimumab onto cycle 3 of chemo in advanced squamous cell carcinoma. And that's based on a randomized phase 2 that was published by Tom Lynch that suggested a potential survival advantage in that group. And let's face it, squamous cell carcinoma, in a sense, really is an unmet need.
Yeah, you know, when you were talking about that first-line therapy, kind of almost reminded me a little bit about what you hear in melanoma and even renal, in that if you have a patient presenting with first-line therapy and they don't need a response, you know, they're not symptomatic, maybe take your shot at throwing them into a long-term response, even though it's not very likely.
The companies logically are restricting those studies to the PD-L1 positive group. I think you're particularly playing with fire if you do that in a PD-L1 negative patient. These folks can progress quite quickly. I've seen some of the PD-L1 positive patients have fairly rampant disease progression. So knowing that we have standard options, both first and second line, unless they qualify for the study based on PD-L1 status, I think it's reasonable not to enroll them.
So one final question. Any thoughts in terms of being able to differentiate anti-PD-1 from anti-PD-L1 at this point? I've heard some discussion about maybe anti-PD-L1 will be less toxic to the lung. I don't know. What's your take on it?
That's my general sense. At least to date, hadn't been associated with any real pulmonary toxicity, which is not the case with nivolumab, the prototypical PD-1 inhibitor. Beyond that, though, the data are remarkably similar. The response rates are about 15 to 20%. There seems to be a preferential effect in PD-L1 positive tumors, regardless of whether they target PD-1 or PD-L1. This notion of pseudoprogression occurs with all of these compounds. The original reports for nivolumab suggested perhaps preferential benefit in squamous cell, and that seems to have fallen by the wayside. But intriguingly, you're seeing response rates that are as good, if not better, in KRAS mutant tumors and in smokers. So if you think about it, perhaps the immunologic aberrations that exist are more profound or more pronounced in smokers or former smokers. And if so, this really does target a population very different from the EGFR mutants and from those with ALK fusion proteins.
It's funny because, you know, I always thought about lung cancer as obviously related to an external carcinogen in so many cases. And as you say, more mutations, more, I don't know, stuff for the immune system to go after. And never really thought about melanoma, but actually melanoma is the same thing in terms of sun.
Absolutely. And probably multiple genetic hits that occur. So the smokers, particularly if they've smoked for quite some time, have multiple DNA abnormalities that you don't typically see in a never smoker with EGFR mutation.
And in the patients you've treated on trial with these various agents, seems like you got a bunch of them on the pembrolizumab. Have you seen any cases of pulmonary toxicity?
Not yet. I'm bracing for it, but not yet. The cooperative groups are highly cognizant of this. Needless to say, the cooperative groups and frankly the companies are highly interested in introducing these agents earlier on to earlier stage disease. For instance, the MedImmune AZ compound is being looked at post-chemoradiation in locally advanced patients.
Wow.
So that's a major leap, and there will be interest, I can guarantee you, in looking at these agents in the adjuvant setting. But once more, we need to figure out who's really going to benefit. And in that regard, stage four disease is really the laboratory that'll help us determine that.
That's cool with the post-chemo radiation. I don't know if that takes advantage of, what's it called, the abscopal effect or something?
Potentially. So there is this phenomenon. It's certainly been nicely documented by the Memorial Sloan Kettering melanoma experts with ipilimumab, that patients who were on the agent actually developed disease progression if they underwent radiation to a selected site, not only had a response at the site, but they had a response at sites that weren't being radiated without any change in the systemic treatment. So abscopal is from the Greek. Ab means far away and scope means target. So when you're actually seeing a remote effect that's occurring due to some really incredible synergy between radiation and just the continued systemic treatment. I don't know if we've seen that documented yet in non-small cell lung cancer. It would be exciting if we did.
So speaking of immunotherapy, I had the pleasure of interviewing your colleague at Penn, Dr. David Porter, who's involved with the really exciting strategy of chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy, particularly in CLL and ALL. Anything going on in terms of CAR T and lung cancer?
We are embarking on a CAR T-cell study in meso. We've actually accrued about six or seven folks, one of whom had, shall we say, a near-death experience, a grade 4.8 toxicity, basically coded as he was getting the infusion. But then,
wow,
fortunately, the pulmonologist, the interventional pulmonologist who was involved, was right there. I mean, pretty much hanging out with these patients as they get their reinfusion of T-cells. And, you know, he saved his life, and he actually did fairly well for a while. He had some tumor shrinkage. And, you know, these are meso patients who are pretty much exhausted any standard therapy. Our hope, probably in the new year, once we've ironed out some of the kinks and have a better handle on preventing toxicity, is to introduce this as an approach in advanced non-small cell. Huh. We would stipulate that they be heavily pretreated, but excellent performance status.
What's the specific antigen being targeted?
They're looking at c-MET as a target. They're looking at a variety of targets. So the problem is, particularly when it comes to c-MET, that so many normal tissues also express that. And these T cells are dumb beasts of burden. They don't really necessarily automatically discriminate between malignant c-MET and benign c-MET. So you can have a whole host of collateral damage, you know, normal tissue toxicity, at least in theory, or might not have any toxicity at all.
Wow.
So it's a one-shot deal. They get pheresed. It takes several weeks, if not a month or two, to cultivate the T cells, to expand them. And then they get reinfused usually over a day or two. And if all goes well, people go home. And then you follow up with scans a month, 2 months later. So we're hoping to, we're actually doing this, as I said, we're doing it in meso of all diseases, certainly a unique approach. They're doing it in breast cancer now. And I think before I expose non-small cell patients who have so many comorbidities, I really want to make sure that we have a better handle on toxicity.
So you're saying breast cancer patients are actually getting the CART therapy?
Yeah. It basically, it's just another form of immunotherapy. Needless to say, this sort of approach is like playing with fire. And I think when we start applying it to solid tumor, we've got to be extraordinarily careful.
So let's move on to your next case. And I always love it when it starts out 89-year-old. I know that's one of your fascinations. So let's hear what happened here.
So this is a lovely gentleman, a school crossing guard. He was continuing to work at the tender age of 89, West Philadelphia native, African-American male with lots of arthritis, heavy smoker in the distant past. 25 years ago, he'd quit at the tender age of 64. Otherwise, fairly unremarkable medical history, a herniorrhaphy, some reflux, esophagitis. He presented with cough and dyspnea on exertion in 2010. His performance status was still intact. It was one, and really largely due to his arthritis. He needed a cane to walk because he essentially had bone-on-bone disease in the right hip. Physical exam was unremarkable, except for restricted motion in the hip. Chest x-ray revealed a right parahilar mass that measured about 4 centimeters. CAT scan confirmed this and showed multiple 1 to 2 centimeter right paratracheal nodes. He underwent a bronchoscopy and EBUS, which showed poorly differentiated squamous cell carcinoma and a right level 4 node. So he was staged based on this bronchoscopy as a T2N2M0. The PET CT lit up only in the areas that we had seen on CAT scan. It was otherwise completely negative with no evidence of disease outside the chest. And he underwent a brain MRI, which was negative. So his clinical pathologic stage was 3A with somewhat bulky central ipsilateral mediastinal adenopathy.
So can you kind of give me a little bit of a picture of kind of what it was like when you walked in his exam room and, you know, what your take was on, you know, his general health, his attitude, and sort of strategically how you're going to think it through more globally?
So if this man were 55 or 60, we wouldn't be discussing his case. This would be a very straightforward instance of locally advanced non-small cell where combined modality is our standard, generally chemoradiation. There's some debate, certainly in younger, fitter patients with non-bulk adenopathy, about potentially pursuing trimodality therapy, chemoradiation up front, followed by surgery. Needless to say, surgery was not a consideration, this gentleman. But we have precious little literature for combined modality past the age of 70, 75. Even between 70 and 80, it's relatively limited. But there are studies, in fact, one very important study from Japan that compared radiation alone to concurrent daily carboplatin, low dose, for 4 weeks with radiation, and showed a striking survival advantage. And there was no real age restriction on that study. These were folks over the age of 70. At 2 and 3 years, the survival rates were double those receiving radiation alone. So for the first time in at least the elderly population, we had validation that a concurrent approach, obviously in relatively selected patients, was better than radiation alone. We certainly had plenty of data before that in a general population showing that concurrent chemoradiation is superior, but relatively little data for the older population. So I discussed all this with him. I explained that 20, 25 years ago, radiation would have been the standard. The likelihood of having long-term survival was no better than 5 or 6 or 7%. We could double, triple, or maybe even quadruple that. On the other hand, you're 89. Treatment of this sort is not a picnic, particularly esophagitis. There's a lot of collateral damage when you combine chemotherapy concurrently with radiation. Beyond esophagitis, there's the prospect of delayed pneumonitis. His disease was fairly confined. The primary lesion was fairly central, and the nodes were immediately adjacent. So in discussion with the radiation oncologist, they made it quite clear that the V20, which is the percentage of non-tumor lung getting more than 20 gray, was relatively low, and that at least projecting forward, they thought he could tolerate treatment with or without chemo. So I did not press him to get the chemotherapy, but I explained that combined modality was superior. I made it quite clear to him that many of his peers in that age range would think me nuts for even considering combined modality. He said, I want the best chance of cure. Very laconic fella, certainly had no angst about his diagnosis. I think at the age of 89, many of our patients don't. And he sailed through treatment. He actually got full dose radiation, got weekly PAC carbo. He got attenuated doses of chemo after the PAC carbo, just 2 cycles of additional PAC carbo. And he had major tumor shrinkage. And he actually lived to the age of 92. He died last year. So he lived about 3 years. His disease never recurred. He ultimately succumbed to, I believe it was pulmonary embolism and some progression of his emphysema, but there was very little radiation sequela, very little in the way of pulmonary fibrosis or other problems.
So I'd say you cured him functionally anyhow.
Functionally. And, you know, this wasn't a small tumor. This was a central tumor. It was already causing cough. When I examined him, there was some perhaps hint of wheezing as well, although it wasn't very obvious. And he wasn't feeling well. I mean, he was still functioning. He was still working, but he clearly knew something was going on.
So I actually interviewed Ross Kamage a couple days ago, and he told me a little anecdote about you, and I promised I'd ask you a question. And actually, this case, I think this case is perfect. He said, ask him if he would do an EGFR or ALK test if they were squamous and a smoker. So did you test this man?
No. As far as I'm concerned, that's still a little bit controversial. Ross and I have actually had this debate on several occasions. His argument is, if you're squamous smoker, male, non-East Asian, granted the chances of having EGFR mutation are probably no better than 1% to 2%. But ROS1 is only 1% to 2%, you know, in the target population. So we wouldn't refrain from doing ROS1. Why refrain from doing EGFR? Ideally, I do agree with him. I think if we could do molecular testing on everyone seamlessly, everywhere, we would just do it. But it's not always so easy. You do have to take the odds to some extent. The likelihood that this gentleman, with the features that he has, is essentially 0 for 4 clinically, the likelihood of his tumor being EGFR mutant positive is no better than 1 or 1.5%. The other issue here, which is unrelated to that question, he has locally advanced disease, not metastatic. And at least in 2014, we have yet to prove that molecular targeted therapy can influence outcome in locally advanced non-small cell. There's a major ongoing randomized study now, the Alliance trial, along with the RTOG Energy Group, where we're taking folks who do have molecular abnormalities. If they've got EGFR activating mutations, they're randomized to erlotinib for 3 months, followed by standard chemoradiation versus chemoradiation alone. And if they have ALK fusion protein, they're randomized to crizotinib for 3 months, followed by chemoradiation versus chemoradiation alone. And to be blunt, if I knew he had one of those abnormalities and he were willing, I would have had no compunction about putting him on that trial at the time. But outside of a clinical trial, at least in non-metastatic disease, non-recurrent disease, there is no proven role for any targeted therapy. And I'm talking about both locally advanced and the adjuvant setting.
Trying to think of the first interview you and I ever did together, but I know it was more than 10 years ago because I was thinking, now you're kind of getting my questions before I can even ask them, because I was going to say to you, suppose he was EGFR ALK positive, and then I was going to say, well, would you have put him on the trial? And you already answered all that, but I don't know. To me, I've got an 89-year-old with this big tumor I'm about to, you know, do chemo radiation on. I mean, really, is it something, giving them a few months to shrink it down, you think that's really
great,
not kosher?
I suppose it's still kosher.
I mean, 89.
Yes, and if they're reluctant, and if things had been a little bit different, if he had a bigger tumor, the radiation oncologists were hemming and hawing about doing concurrent, or he had some reticence about the chemo, I probably would have done that. But an otherwise motivated patient who's a candidate for concurrent chemoradiation, I'm a strict constructionist. I'll give them what I know to be potentially curative therapy. As much as we're enthralled with the responses we see with EGFR TKIs and those with activating mutations or crizotinib or some of the newer second-line ALK inhibitors and those with the fusion protein, I have yet to see any data whatsoever that shows these compounds can cure people. All the data are in stage 4. We had the recent presentation by Karen Kelly of the Radiant trial in the adjuvant setting that looked at erlotinib versus placebo. Now, granted, the percentage of patients with mutation on that trial relatively limited. But even in that group, although we saw a major PFS advantage, about a 20-month improvement in progression-free survival, at least to date, that has not translated into survival advantage.
So I take it that means you're not using erlotinib off study in the adjuvant setting right now.
I can assure you I don't.
So let's finish out talking about your last case, a 65-year-old lady.
So this is a fascinating patient, a 65-year-old Caucasian female, never smoker, equestrian. She is a retired physical education teacher, and she presented almost a decade ago now, in 2005, with a 2 cm right supraclavicular node, bulky paratracheal and subcarinal adenopathy, and a fairly prominent mass in the left lower lobe, about 5 centimeters. There were some satellite nodules adjacent to the mass. There appeared to be an adrenal mass on CT PET, though it wasn't completely clear. It certainly wasn't very large. Biopsy of the supraclave node on the right showed adenocarcinomas, TTF1 positive, essentially clinching this as a non-small cell lung cancer. Brain MRI was negative, excellent performance status, and we treated her based on our presumption of stage 4 disease with the satellite nodules and possible adrenal lesion. She received Paccarbo and bevacizumab. She had a wonderful response. She had about 80-90% regression after 6 cycles. The right supraclave node essentially resolved. She had marked decrease in the mediastinal lymph nodes and a decrease in the left lower lobe mass to 1.5-2 centimeters. And whatever was going on in the left adrenal seemed to disappear. She received maintenance therapy with bevacizumab for about 4 cycles and was assessed by radiation oncology. And at that point, again, thinking outside the box, we elected to treat the remaining sites of disease with radiation as well as concurrent low-dose weekly Paccarbo. And for about 2 years, her CTs and PETs essentially looked like a clinical CR. She was doing great. She was off treatment. In 2008, unfortunately, she developed progression in the primary, in the left lower lobe, and also in the left adrenal. So that left adrenal lesion, which we had questioned, was in fact real. It was biopsy proven. At this point, remember, it's 2008. We knew about EGFR mutations. We tested for it. It was negative. And she resumed treatment with cytotoxic therapy. At this point, she got pemetrexed, which she had not been exposed to. It's probably our premier agent in adenocarcinoma of the lung. She got this in combination with carboplatin for 6 cycles. Remember, it had been 2.5 years since she had been platinum exposed. And the left adrenal metastasis resolved. There was marked decrease in the left lower lobe lesion from about 3 to 1.5 centimeters. And then she continued on Pemetrex maintenance until about 2012. And I would guesstimate she received about 45 or 50 doses of Pemetrexed.
Were you treating her at that time?
Yes. I've been treating her right along. I originally managed her at Fox Chase, and then in 2008, when I moved to Penn, she followed me.
What was your thinking when you treated her with the PEM carbo and then the PEM maintenance in terms of Bev?
Mixed thoughts. I was concerned because she had had such extensive radiation that, again, there are some data after full-dose radiation that you may create fistulae and bleeding, and she'd been off treatment for quite a while. I thought the safe and prudent approach would be PEM carbo. I certainly considered reintroducing the bevacizumab.
So before we go on to the interesting part, or more interesting part, I think, of the story, just to take a breath and ask you where you are today in terms of treating, I guess, what we're calling pan-wild-type adenocarcinoma systemically, both in terms of induction and maintenance, and what are some of the key trials out there right now?
So for this group, for non-squamous, triple-negative, if you wish, or at least the triple-negative version of non-small cell lung cancer, I will typically treat with PEM-carbo, and I will frequently graft bevacizumab onto that if there are no contraindications. So no active brain mets, no antecedent hemoptysis, no ongoing thromboembolic phenomena. I will give the bevacizumab. Now, the argument against that, one could say, is the Point Break trial, which compared that regimen to PAC-carbo-bev and really showed no obvious survival advantage, but from a toxicity standpoint, is far better tolerated. Patients don't develop neuropathy. They don't lose their hair. They look like normal human beings. And more importantly, they feel like normal human beings. And remember, they're only getting treatment every 3 weeks. If they go through 4 to 6 cycles and they've stabilized or responded, I will continue maintenance, usually the combo if I can. Now, I do not have survival data justifying that, but we do have PFS data. The Avapril trial actually assessed that. They compared bevacizumab alone as maintenance to PEMBEV in combination, and there was about 3.6 months. It was a doubling in progression-free survival, and there was a trend toward improved survival, but that trial, unfortunately, was underpowered for a survival benefit. So we'll never know on the basis of that trial if there was a survival advantage. And then the Point Break trial in the landmark analysis actually had the same approach. It was either bevacizumab alone in the control arm or Bev and Pem in combination. And there was a 2-month difference in progression-free survival and a 2-month difference in overall survival. And unfortunately, we have never seen either the p-values or the hazard ratios for that. So if I can, I do continue it. Sometimes the reason I don't give it has nothing to do with the patient or the drugs. It has to do with the insurers. They'll say pick one or the other, but not both. If they're elderly or have compromised renal function, they'll get taxanes, and frequently there I'll give them weekly paclitaxel or weekly nab-paclitaxel. Remember, pemetrexed is not reliable or necessarily safe if the creatinine clearance is below 45. There's relative paucity of data in that situation and very unpredictable pharmacokinetics.
Could you talk a little bit about the issue of safety and efficacy of Bev in older people as you've studied it in the Point Break and 4599 trial?
So as background, there was a secondary analysis authored by Suresh Ramalingam that looked at bevacizumab in combination with chemo versus chemo alone in those over 70. Again, it was a retrospective analysis of ECOG 4599 alone. There was a borderline PFS advantage, but no obvious survival advantage, and as one might expect, a lot more toxicity. So there was this general mindset that bevacizumab was less safe and less effective in the elderly. And that mindset, I think, has prevailed more and more. What we did is a joint analysis of both Point Break and ECOG 4599, basically comparing the PAC-carbo-BEV arms of both trials. Remember, that was the experimental arm of 4599 and the control arm of Point Break, and compared it to the control arm of 4599, so PAC-carbo alone. Obviously, lots of caveats there. This is a joint analysis of two different trials. Nevertheless, these two trials had virtually identical eligibility criteria, and although they weren't done contemporaneously, they weren't so many years apart that there were really major differences in outcome. If you look at PAC-carbo-BEV in the elderly compared to chemo alone, a very interesting discriminant comes up. The survival advantage, the hazard ratio for that survival advantage, seems to persist up until the age of 75. Beyond 75, that advantage is lost. If anything, the control group does a little bit better. And there is still heightened toxicity. There were something like 8 grade 5 events compared to 2 or 3 in the control group. So you have to keep that in mind. But nevertheless, at least in the elderly and based on these data, which are really virtually the only data that exist, for those between 70 and 75, I'll still offer bevacizumab. I'm a lot less enthused beyond 75.
Let's finish out and talk about what happened with this patient, because it was pretty interesting.
So she was on maintenance therapy for quite some time until 2012. This is 7 years into our diagnosis. Now, mind you, she's PS0 through this entire time period. She's continuing to ride horses. She is fully functional. She feels wonderful. Basically parks herself in the infusion room every 3 weeks for about half an hour. And at that point, unfortunately, her scans showed some new right lower lobe nodules. There was slight interval growth in the left lower lobe mass. Because it was so questionable, we actually initially elected to continue pemetrexed for 3 more cycles. But follow-up imaging later that year showed further progression. And at this point, we were aware of ALK translocations. Remember when she had been first diagnosed, we knew nothing about that. We barely knew about EGFR mutations. She was a never smoker. She was EGFR negative. I was basically counting on her being ALK positive. Unfortunately, I was proven right. We did a biopsy of the right lower lobe mass. It showed recurrent adenocarcinoma, TTF1 positive, ALK positive. She was started on crizotinib, and up until very recently, she had near resolution of these two discrete right lower lobe masses, marked improvement in the left lower lobe mass. And it's only this past summer, after nearly 2 years on crizotinib, that we've seen some interval growth in this left lower lobe mass. So at this point, we're considering going to second-line treatment. And, of course, ceritinib, the LTK378 drug, was just approved in this setting. So first, I think it's remarkable. This woman has lived 9 years with metastatic disease. When I started out, when I finished my fellowship in 1987, it was rare to see patients live a year, let alone 2 years. I mean, it was just unusual. We had a very limited therapeutic armamentarium, platinum-based treatment. We had pitched debates whether the treatment was worse than the disease. We don't do that anymore. Now it's pitched debates whether we should give third or fourth line treatment. And I certainly the advent of what I call the molecular revolution has really changed how we approach these patients.
The only thing is that most of this lady's time with metastatic disease, she's not been on targeted therapy. She's been on chemotherapy or bevacizumab.
Well, I think the chemo's improved as well.
Well, also the question of chemosensitivity and PEM utility, specifically in ALK-positive disease. What do we know about the natural history, irrespective of the targeted therapy?
Well, the Shaw paper, I think, is highly instructive. This is a randomized trial of crizotinib versus standard second-line, either pemetrexed or docetaxel, in the second-line setting in patients who had had disease progression on platinum-based combos. And needless to say, crizotinib did better than chemo, but pemetrexed did better than docetaxel. And whether this is due to ALK or due to the fact that the vast majority of these patients have adenocarcinoma, and we already have data from the past that pemetrexed is probably a better drug against adenocarcinoma. So I'm not necessarily convinced that it's an ALK-driven phenomenon, though I'm intrigued by the possibility. Nevertheless, if I had a patient who progressed on crizotinib and, for that matter, ceritinib, if they had gone through standard ALK regimens and they had not yet received chemotherapy, pemetrexed would be my standard drug.
So another question I want to ask you, maybe this is not going to come up in this lady, but in terms of, again, pan-wild type or triple-negative disease, I'm curious how you approach, as you move down into second- and third-line therapy, the issue of choice of treatment and the role, if any, in your practice of erlotinib and the use of the VeriStrat assay.
So first off, in this pan-negative patient has been off platinum for really since her diagnosis, I would have very low threshold for going back to a platinum combination, perhaps with a partner drug that she's not yet received. So that would be one approach. I do use VeriStrat. I think its utility is in trying to figure out who should not get erlotinib. So again, this is a serum proteomic approach that is unclear what we're actually determining. It may be amyloid protein, it may be something else. Those who have protein peaks, at least both in retrospective series and now in the prospective PROS trial, seem to do better with chemotherapy compared to erlotinib. This sort of patient, let's assume that she was ALK negative or, you know, that she's gone through standard chemo and has managed to get 8 or 9 years out of it. I think my next step in her would certainly be to re-biopsy and test for PD-L1. I'd go back to at least the option of immunotherapy. She's not received gemcitabine. She's not received vinorelbine. Now, you could argue they aren't terribly effective as third or fourth line drugs, but you know, that's in the conventional setting when patients have progressed after 6 months or a year. This is a woman who's seen 8 or 9 years with just two different chemo regimens. So I think all bets are off. In her specific case, the standard approach, if she had more generalized progression, would probably be ceritinib, the LDK378 drug. We're about to reopen a trial, a randomized trial of the ARIAD compound, AP26113, at two different doses precisely in this setting. And I've been dawdling a little bit in terms of putting her on that trial because the pace of progression is so slow and she's feeling so well.
What about other second-generation ALK inhibitors in development? One I've been hearing a lot about is alectinib.
So we have at least 4 and counting agents in this setting, which is really sort of ironic since ALK fusion proteins are found only in about 3 to 8% of all non-small cell. So for this tiny segment of lung cancer, we have 4 different active drugs, none of which we knew about 5 years ago.